Hello, this week's Bruin podcast is for me, Guy Foster, and I'm speaking to Elliot Hentoff, Head of Policy Research at State Street Global Advisors. Now, Elliot knows everything there is to know about the forthcoming US election, but bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change, and remember, Elliot's going to give you some of the possible election scenarios and what they can mean for markets. But you must bear in mind that when investing your capital is at risk, investment values can increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. Now, I'm sure we all want to know who's going to be the leader of the free world for the next 4 years, so let's find out. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this latest Bruin podcast. And on this occasion, we're delighted to be joined by Elliot Hentoff, who is the Head of Policy Research at State Street Global Advisors. And he's going to be talking us through the big market issue coming up over the next few weeks. And it is, I guess, really that close. And that obviously is the US election. So, Elliot, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you for having me.
I think we'll start off with a fairly straightforward question. If you could just clarify for us, who is going to win the US presidential election?
Well, that's a very simple, straightforward question. Well, who's going to win? Well, certainly the media will generate ratings as a result of the election, so that's a certainty. But which of the candidates will emerge victorious? Is frankly, there's really the two top contenders are either Joseph Biden and the other one is not Donald Trump, but the other one is a dispute. Those are the two favored scenarios in our election model. And Donald Trump comes a very distant third in the probabilities of outcomes.
Right. Wow. Okay. Well, that's quite a contentious suggestion then. So, when I ask other people, I think their views tend to be that tend to fall 50-50 between former President Biden, as you mentioned, but also President Trump, on the basis that he does appear to be behind. So was Hillary Clinton, and we all saw how that worked out. So, I mean, do you think there's a big chance of that the polls and the forecast models and things like that might be wrong again this time, and perhaps we'll be looking at four more years of President Trump after all?
We could be looking at four more years of President Trump, but there's virtually close to zero chance that that would occur without passing through what would be a tumultuous, highly contested, disputed election prior. So if he does emerge victorious, it will not be smooth and there will not be messages of congratulations the way we're used to from previous elections. I do want to clarify things for your listeners about the polls and polling quality. In a country as vast as the US, the polling average nationally put Hillary Clinton at plus 3%. She eventually won at plus 2.1. That's actually a fairly good polling result for accuracy. The individual states, in about 45 of the states, the polling, the result was within the margin of error of the polls, and only two states was it clearly outside of the margin of error. However, those were two very fatal, critical states, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, that made all the difference, in which, let's again bear in mind, Trump squeezed through by a whisker. Now, in those states specifically and across all the other polls, pollsters have now corrected for that mistake. But again, the correction is based on assumptions. Who's going to show up to vote? Who's actually going to make the effort to get the mail-in ballot? And those assumptions could still skew the polls. That said, when you have national and individual states all moving in the same direction as we've had it over the last 10 days, it's unlikely to be a polling mistake. It's just a question of magnitude of the move.
I mean, this issue of mail-in votes, obviously a big one. I mean, is there not a risk that people intend to vote by mail-in ballot, but sort of don't get round to it? It requires a bit more sort of planning than just sort of turning up at your polling station. I mean, it seems such a big uncertainty, I guess, that's the point, that how can, if you're going to have a materially larger number of people using mail-in ballots, then will the polling services correctly compute how many of those ballots actually end up being cast?
The question is definitely valid. It looks like, obviously, to get your voters to vote by mail requires a level of voter enthusiasm. I want to remind the listeners that in 2018, we had the highest voter turnout for the midterm elections in over 100 years. Yes, you heard me right, 100-year high in voter turnout. I have no doubt that that voter enthusiasm remains elevated to this day. So I would expect, yes, it's burdensome, and the pandemic is probably going to lower turnout compared to what it would have been without, but I still expect a record turnout that perhaps even a record of the past 20, 25 years for this year's election. The other thing I want to flag, yes, you talk about problems with the mail-in vote, but bear in mind, it's like the Electoral College. We're not talking about one election. We're talking about 50 parallel election systems and election processes, some of which are very adept at using them and will not have any issues, and others which are completely unfamiliar and unprepared, and where you'll have mistakes and scandals along the way. Some of the swing states fall into either bucket, and that is also partially why our alternate scenario is the dispute scenario, because while we think Biden is favored, if the result comes down to these two or three states where they're not used to mail-in ballots, it's a swing state and the margin is tight, you then get a recipe for disaster.
And the mail-in ballots are assumed to favor Joe Biden. And so there have been suggestions, there are suggestions that on the evening of the election or the morning after the election, the popular vote might still be in favor of President Trump, and that actually it's going to take some, I don't know what, days, weeks, to actually get to the point where Vice President Biden overtakes him and shows that he's won the election. Is that what you expect to happen?
By and large, that is what we expect to happen. But this is why it is a numbers game. If the margin is, if Joe Biden continues to pull at a national average of 9% ahead of the president, then that story is less relevant because enough states start counting ballots before or on election day. So they would be able to already deliver very credible trends by, you know, maybe not midnight, but certainly by the next day. There's other states that will only open the ballot boxes the night of after the election has passed. So it really does boil down to the margin. And then also, if you think about the margin for dispute, again, mail-in ballots have a much higher rate of disqualification. We, as you pointed out, roughly 3-1 is expected to go to Joe Biden among mail-in ballots. So obviously a high disqualification rate there could really twist the story. So it's really, but it's ultimately a numbers game. It's basically, as for your listeners, as a shortcut, if Joe Biden's up 5 or 6%, given mail-in balloting, you will definitely have a disputed election. If he's up 8 or 9, you probably will not.
Okay.
And anything in between is a question mark.
Okay. So talk to us about this disputed election scenario then. I mean, what's the reality of that? What happens when the election gets disputed?
Yeah, Guy, I'll tell you, before we even get to that, let's talk about what's happening today. What I think is useful is watch what the candidates and their campaigns are doing. Are they spending money on ads? Or are they hiring lawyers? Are they preparing for disruption? Are they, you know, lobbying for certain campaign laws? That tells you how much the parties themselves are expecting a dispute. And you can see here that one campaign is very much positioning for the post-election challenges, and that's obviously the Trump campaign more so than the Biden campaign, both in terms of money, resources, manpower, and policy moves. So I just want to point that out. It's not something that will surprise us the day after the election. It's things, processes that are set in motion today. And how does it work? Now, first of all, it's not irrational for either candidate to contest results. The U.S. system, 50 separate elections, separate election laws, election commissions, and separate courts, judiciary that govern that. So there is an opportunity when if things are close or if there's a debacle in one of the states, to use legal or political means to either overturn or challenge or prevent the certification of the election result. And basically, it comes down to three strategies. Either you just, what we call the muck it up strategy, where you flood the courts with challenges simply with the objective to prevent the certification. And why would you do that? Well, if neither candidate gets the famous 270 electoral votes, it then moves to the House of Representatives in a convoluted process to choose the president. In that process, the Republicans have a built-in majority, so only Trump would use this strategy, muck it up, get the courts, prevent the certification, simply stop Biden from getting the 270, and then have the election move to the House of Representatives.
Okay, so you've got to just clarify for us then, if it goes to the House of Representatives, obviously the Democrats have a majority, significant majority in the House of Representatives. So why do the Republicans have a built-in advantage?
Yeah, because the House of Representatives is usually one man, one vote, or one representative, one vote. But simply for the case of a tied election or one where neither candidate wins the Electoral College, it's one state, one vote. And the Republicans have the majority of state delegations. Although they have a smaller number of representatives overall, you know, think of California with its 50 representatives, roughly. Those are just one vote in that scenario. So it's voted similar to the way that the Senate is set up, but it takes place in the House of Representatives. So each state gets one vote, and currently it's 26 Republican delegations, 23 Democratic in one split. So perhaps after the election, it would be more like 26-24, but currently it looks like they still have a majority.
Okay, and it would be what, the current House or the new House that would have that vote?
It would be the new House. So there is a slight chance that it would shift in favor of the Democrats, but that's unlikely, because if it were to shift in favor of the Democrats, you probably do not have a disputed election, because that would mean some of the swing states clearly swung the other way.
Okay, so that's the muck it up strategy. All sounds very cynical. Take us through the other options then.
The other options, now that one's only available to Trump currently. The other options are a little bit more equitable, which is that you use the courts to challenge a result or to freeze a preferred result. So either stop ballot counting or you make sure the courts can issue a ruling to continue ballot counting. And this is the scenario of the 2000 vote. Eventually that went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court back then, if you recall, George W. Bush hadn't won the election, but the court had ruled that the ballot counting should stop. And that basically meant that the result at that given moment in time was declared the final one. And so that could be a scenario here. And again, that's why the Supreme Court is relevant. But it doesn't even have to go to the Supreme Court. It could work its way through local state-level courts, state Supreme Courts, before it gets to that. And either party could find a very friendly ruling, and sometimes that ruling will stand no matter what. And in that case, you get the courts to deliver the outcome you want, which, again, in what the scenario you described, it's more likely than not Trump would seek to stop certain ballot counting, because he's more likely to do well the earlier the ballots are counted.
Okay. And on the subject of the Supreme Court then, obviously that's a very hot and contentious issue at the moment. I mean, I just wonder, is this whole debate over how many liberals and how many conservatives you have on the Supreme Court, is it as significant as people suggest it is? Because obviously, I think President Trump's previous nominee to the Supreme Court, his first nominee to the Supreme Court, has actually ended up not being quite as much of a friend to him as had been anticipated. Presumably, these judges don't just make every decision along political party lines, but instead should be giving real consideration to application of the law.
The evidence does not bear that out. to be very honest. By and large, most of the justices have been predictable voters in the critical, polarizing cases that have come before them. And that's simply the evidence. There's one or two very famous exceptions over the last 10, 15 years, but they're few and far between. I think I would note on the Supreme Court that the two appointees by Trump currently on the court, and now the third one, are the first in the history of the United States of America to have been nominated by a president who won a minority of the vote and to be approved by a Senate, a group of senators that represent a minority of the vote. And I think one has to really, you do not have to be an expert in constitutional democracy to understand that that is a recipe for partisanship that will, and constitutional problems down the line. I don't think there's an investment thesis around the court in the short term, but it does raise, it basically guarantees in many ways the EMSification of the United States in the coming years. And we see this in the electoral process. The fact that we're doing this podcast around a disputed election is something that I used to do very adeptly for emerging markets that I followed, but I've now had to apply the same analytics to the US.
Right, wow, that's not quite in line with the concept of making America great again. Okay, so that was the overturn scenario, and that's about trying to get the vote counting to stop in a way that's going to suit President Trump. You had another scenario, did you? Or another strategy? Yeah,
so in both those cases, just from a market perspective, the show ends by mid-December. So those courts would have to decide at the latest 8th or 14th of December. So you, at some point, you do get certainty. You may still get unrest and the opposite public outcry, but you'll get some legal certainty by the second week of December. In the third scenario, you don't. And in the third scenario, you get competing jurisdictions and electoral commissions making decisions. And basically, there's a result. One side doesn't accept the result, either because too many ballots were disqualified or too many were not disqualified. And then either the state legislature or the governor decides, from opposing parties, decide to credit the opposite result, and a state issues two results. And that can easily happen because of the way the law is written. The way the law is written is that the state legislature certifies the result, and then the governor sends in the result to Congress. And so in this case, basically both organs would think that they have a role to play. And what you get then is you get basically a state that's basically one outcome is for Trump and one for Biden, and they both show up to the Electoral College. Let's imagine the 10 electors of Wisconsin. You have Trump electors and Biden electors. They both show up, and then Congress in January would have to somehow decide who are the true electors and who are the fake ones. So, you know, you'd not only have fake news, but you'd have fake electors at that stage, and that would be well into January. And the reality is this has never happened before, and there's no foolproof, hardwired clarity in the Constitution as to how that conundrum would be resolved. But Congress, in one shape or another, would have to vote on which electors to credit or not.
The whole of Congress or the House of Representatives?
No, in that case, because of course, to make it more confusing, it's the whole of Congress, and it's particularly the Senate with the vice. So it's each chamber votes separately, and you can obviously imagine how the House of Representatives would vote, this time by simple majority, and then the Senate. And then apparently, if the two chambers do not agree, the vice president is the tie-breaking vote, which at that stage could, of course, be, could still be Mike Pence voting for himself as the tie-breaking vote. That's one scenario. There's other scenarios that say that may be, but then the House of Representatives still needs to procedurally allow the vote to come to a close, which of course Nancy Pelosi would not do. And the one thing we know for certain is that on January 20th, the first term of the president ends. It ends, and there's no way to stop that. And so the one constitutional group says, well, the House, Nancy Pelosi would run the clock out until January 20th, when she would become the president as the third in the row, third in succession. Whereas Republican constitutionalists say that's nonsense. If the vice president delivers a tie-breaking vote, it's a procedural issue. The House of Representatives cannot block something based on procedure. That would not be constitutionally all right. So you could see, my point is here for markets, this is the nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
You have uncertainty rise in November. It escalates. You get higher volatility. You get drawdowns in the equity markets. You get a disorderly depreciation of the dollar. Then you get households cutting back, businesses delaying investment. And it upsets the entire macro recovery that we would otherwise see in Q4 and Q1. And obviously, if that goes on for 1 week, it's one thing. But if it goes on till mid-January, we're obviously in hot water. Again, it's not our base case scenario, but there's a fat tail risk associated with it.
Okay, so look, I mean, we've talked about some disputed election scenarios, and you've mentioned that collectively, I guess, or that last one in particular is the worst market outcome. What's the best market outcome? What are your thoughts on that? What would be the best thing for the market when this election is held?
Hypothetically, just from a pure stock market point of view, a smooth, credible re-election of the president would probably be the optimal outcome. The problem is that's not on the menu. That is simply not likely to happen, because we just do not see something really dramatic, spectacular would need to happen to upset the election dynamic at this stage. So of the available, of the realistic options that are out there, probably the optimal outcome is a smooth election of Joseph Biden that's credibly recognized, that concludes with very little delay and of high certainty. Now, there is a debate whether markets would welcome a split Congress more than a Democratic sweep. And I think this is a more legitimate argument. Traditionally, I think markets would welcome gridlock, particularly gridlock on a Democratic president who's promised a series of tax increases and regulatory tightening. That is traditionally the case. However, we are wondering whether, if you look at 2016, the election night as results came in, when it looked like Trump was winning, the markets did not like it. But the moment they saw that Trump would win with both houses of Congress, meaning that there would be no more gridlock, that's when markets really rallied. And we actually think markets would welcome a Democratic sweep, despite the fact that some of the headwinds it would generate from a policy perspective, and they're not fully priced in at this stage. But, you know, markets like certainty. I think a Democratic sweep would deliver certainty as to what would be coming, and markets could then very quickly reprice the coming policy mix over the next year or two.
I'm really interested in this, and I think it's, you know, my perception is it's pretty difficult to tell what the market would like, because there's these sort of there's these quite tangible challenges from a Biden presidency, particularly a Democratic sweep one, where there's going to be some tax increases and regulations going to get a bit tighter. And you won't get that with a Trump presidency, but at the same time, President Trump hasn't really been that much of a friend to the markets because of a lot of the geopolitical uncertainty that he creates. So, I mean, do you think there's a scenario where, even though the market at the moment before the election does seem to sell off when it looks like Trump's chances are getting even worse? But could it not like flip round in the same way that it did, that you just described in 2016, where actually once you know what the new scenario is going to be and that it's a change of power, actually the market just manages to see the bright side of whatever situation it's faced with?
By and large, I would agree with you. I think the one thing we know, markets dislike uncertainty.
Yeah.
They clearly have a preference for certainty over uncertainty. That's indisputable. And now, one of the reasons I think it would follow that pattern is, okay, if markets knew on November 4th that the Biden agenda will be implemented in full with, you know, several of the left-wing part of the Democratic Party in key critical appointments and pursuing their agenda, then I think the result would be very mixed. But that's not going to be the case. Bear in mind, the only thing the market will know is perhaps the presidency and maybe the Senate composition. What it will not know at that stage is the magnitude of the agenda that gets implemented. And that's dependent on a lot of other variables that even I, although it's my full-time job, cannot fully predict at this stage. I had basically advised people that when Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg, died, that made the odds of a stimulus package much lower in 2020. But what does that mean? Well, what's the first thing in the in-tray of President Biden if he gets elected? Well, he needs to make up for the lost stimulus bill that failed to materialize. So that's task number one. If the Supreme Court justice is seated by November, it's likely the Supreme Court will strike down Obamacare. Well, what else is in his in-tray? He'll have to fix the healthcare law that was broken. So, you know, there's a lot, the agenda will be flooded with all sorts of competing priorities. So the likelihood is that a lot of the less appetizing stuff from a market perspective is likely to get diluted in the first year of the administration. And so that's partially why we've turned cautiously risk on as a result of the election dynamic in the past 2 weeks.
So perhaps you could update us. I mean, what is the current strategy then of the administration with regard to replacing Chief Justice Ginsburg?
Well, the strategy is she will be replaced. I'd be willing to bet money on the fact that she will take her seat in November. I'm not sure exactly what time period, whether it's in time for the healthcare ruling or not, but I would presume yes.
Before the election.
Yeah, she will be confirmed before the election, and I think there's a process, but before she actually down, I think she'll take her seat in the interim period between election and inauguration day. So that will happen, and that's obviously also going to raise the issue of the Supreme Court itself as a problem for the next Democratic administration, because that Supreme Court is more likely to strike down laws that were passed in Congress, and which is what I'm back to the theme around EMification of the U.S., where yeah. you weaken the governance structure. We've seen an erosion of institutions over the last 25 years in America continuously, well before the Trump era, and certainly likely to continue after the Trump era as well. And that theme is one that's playing out very slowly, but becomes very, very difficult.
Turning to some of these implications then, I think one of the ones which has had investors scratching their heads a little bit is what the implications are for big technology companies, because Vice President Biden has not been completely clear on what stance he takes on them, but there are a number of other Democrats who are much more concerned about big technology. So what's your expectation about the prospects for that sector or any action that might be taken against them?
The reality is that, again, and you have to differentiate between what is on the menu and what will actually get implemented, passed as law, instituted as regulation. But if you look at the agenda and just seriously read through the proposals, tech is in the crosshairs of a variety of core policy objectives of the Democrats. And not because it's tech, but simply because they seek to rebalance the playing field, weaken oligopolistic or monopolistic pricing power. They seek to redistribute concentrations in wealth and in income. And these overarching objectives are being translated into changes in the tax code, in regulation, antitrust enforcement, that would disadvantage the tech sector compared to its position today. Which, by the way, Guy, if you play around with the numbers yourself, look at which sectors have correlated most with Trump's polling numbers, and you'll find it's the tech sector. And it's not a coincidence. It's not necessarily because the tech sector supports his reelection, but that the status quo, of course, is better than any change that could possibly be coming. And I want to remind listeners the historical context. It's rare to get these levels of overconcentration in an equity index the way we have it today. And in previous episodes, when that overconcentration reached certain levels, you had either of two consequences. One was there was a price implosion, basically a bubble bursting. You've seen that in the financial sector, you've seen that dot-com 20 years ago. Or you saw policy intervention, where basically the government stepped in and made sure to redistribute in one form or another that started to shrink margins. So there is that risk. That said, and I really have to temper that because I want to be candid here, we are not recommending anybody sell out of the U.S. tech sector. But obviously, we do expect some margin compression. We do expect the earnings forecast to flatten a little bit compared to some of the rosy outlooks. But the growth, the businesses, these are still businesses that whose basic value proposition remains intact. Perhaps a little bit less rewarding for shareholders compared to the status quo environment if the Democrats get in, but nonetheless still very compelling.
So what are you expecting then? Changes to taxation that are impactful on margins and such like, or do you think these ideas of breakups and particularly disaggregation from marketplaces are those realistic policies? Or just give us your thoughts on that.
Those are the existential ones. And I'm not sure if they will come to fruition, but the Democrats will take a serious look. If you follow the congressional hearings and the line of thought and you read what's in the Democratic agenda, they are reinventing antitrust policy and the drivers of antitrust that could lead to either a breakup of certain companies or the regulation of certain business models that does change the structural margins. That is, by the way, that is the worst case. The more probable is simply changes in the tax code that are designed to claw back a lot of the gains of recent years, and also to make some of the tax engineering that these companies profit from so well less rewarding. You know, think about it. One of the, usually doesn't come up, but if you look at one of the tax loopholes they want to close is the valuation of intellectual property and intangible value, and that's code for, of course, tech, where a lot. If you look at the balance sheets, a lot of that runs through these types of tax loopholes. But on antitrust, I want to really highlight two points. Classic antitrust policy is based on the idea of consumer protection. You want to make sure the consumer has ample choice and gets the best price. That is not or no longer the sole driver of antitrust philosophy among the Democrats. They've added one or two new ones. And one is around the consumer needs to be protected as an actor in the marketplace. Now, that philosophical change means, translated in plain English, basically the user and his data have to be protected in a way that's, you have to think about the consumer differently. It's not about whether he or she is getting the right price, but is he or she getting treated fairly and responsibly? And the second novel thinking is around, well, it's not necessarily price does not tell us whether the marketplace is healthy. It's the multitude of competition and the presence of multiple suppliers and buyers that tell us a system is healthy. And so that's another code for saying, well, let's look at perhaps Amazon and some of the other platforms that dominate, not whether they deliver efficient pricing, but whether they deliver an ecosystem of competition. So this may sound like nuance, but it's actually quite revolutionary thinking in terms of antitrust.
Okay. Well, listen, Elliot, that's been absolutely fantastic. There's so much information in there that we could talk to you for hours, but unfortunately we're not allowed to because your time is precious and so is that of our listeners. So Elliot Hentov, Head of Policy Research at State Street Global Advisors, thank you so much for going through that with us. And thank you also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found that interesting. We will be speaking more about the election over the coming weeks, and we hope that you will join us then and for other Bruin podcasts as well. Thanks for joining us.